Okay. So this is then an introduction to evaluation based on Rogers and the interaction design beyond human-computer interaction. And you, Øyvind, will also add something from Johnson's book, isn't it? Benyon, sorry. But it's really about the why, the what, the where, when, using evaluation, the types, different types, how you inform participants, getting consents, and we talked about this, the importance of getting a consent, and how do you deal with that more practical. It's about how you interpret the data you get in an evaluation. So when you sit later on and when you evaluate the other groups, how should you interpret it? What type of what is made it reliable, the evaluation? How can you talk about validity? How is it valid? How has it value? In what context? Biases and the scope. Is it a very broad? Is it a very narrow evaluation? So Rogers and co, they talk about why you should evaluate is that it's more than about it's being a usable system. It's also the field it comes from, ergonomics, human factors, big factories where you produce cars or you make big tools or something like that. But it's more about creating engaging experiences when you use digital media, when you use social media and so on. It's more complex services. It's physical and on a smartphone and it's cross platforms. It makes it even more complex. And it's also the services from being one tractor that everybody used the same, because everybody that used the tractor was an expert, a farmer. But to now, it's more person-centered. Every person is an individual. We have a more individual culture, at least here in the West, in Western countries. But and the person-centered services within healthcare, for instance, are very. It's a very big field where you need to trim your to use really reflect on how you evaluate. And there's also a business and marketing perspective. Think about some of the answers that Sebastian gave. It's very much about return on investment. It's very much something about either you increase return on investment or decrease the cost, the spending. So it's in the end of the day, he has to take into consideration economical perspectives. Yeah. If he's not on plus in the end of the week, he will be put on a list, and after a month he will be kicked out. that's his everyday. And then, of course, when it's more complex and in every way and all those arguments here, then it's also more important to have good evaluation methods. So what? You can evaluate low-tech prototypes, your paper prototypes, for instance, or more complex systems. You can evaluate detailed screen functions, very detailed things, very small, a button. You can make a button in 100 different ways, and you can evaluate how it works and so on. Or you can evaluate whole workflows, how an organization is interacting with its customers in every meeting point you can see and so on. You can evaluate the aesthetics. You got some feedback today on aesthetics in what you presented. But then, yeah, and you can get into all these fields, and for aesthetic, you could get into to see formal aspects, but you can also evaluate what the user thinks, and it might not be what is formally beautiful or good, or that won a prize or anything in a design award, but it might be something that is evaluated bottom up. And I, who comes from a sound and a music perspective, I've been working a lot with elderly people in Sweden and in Norway also, where they choose dance music, oldies, and I'm not very fond of that, and so is not my very elitistic background and in classical music and so on. They are not so fond of Swedish dansbandsmusik. They are not that. It's not their favorites. It meaning that they, what they value as aesthetically interesting, is something that I can't really, I can't use my, I would be biased if I used my elitistic classical music standards based on Mozart and Beethoven, if you understand what I mean. And this is, you can get in detail in every area, but when it comes to, you can also analyze, many times you analyze safety features. Is it the traffic lights is one aspect, and you could say, can you really make a bad traffic light? Yes, you can. And of course, this has to be evaluated. You can evaluate fun, the playability in games, of course. You can, and also reactions to design, user behavior, and reactions, are they valued from a perceptual, psychological, perceptual perspective, or are they evaluated as interactions in a communication, media and communication perspectives? And then I put in an exercise here. It's based on the book. How many have books with them? You could. It's about. It's on page 455. Do you have the book? Because you could. There are some two questions, I think, about what aspects would you evaluate. If you do, it's a small activity, 13.2. 13.2. Here, one. If you please could... yeah. If you please could do that in groups, and is it okay if... How many have not a book? Could one of them borrow your book? Yep. Is that okay? If you don't have a book, be in a group that has one. And take 10, 15 minutes to do that. And if I read the questions... You can do it. Four is okay. A personal music player. What aspects would you want to evaluate for the following systems? A personal music player. And number two, a website for selling clothes. And discuss it. Thank you.
No. Thank you.
Okay. Are you?
I'm not sure if we got exactly what they are doing. Do we have to follow the book or do we have to use the list?
You follow the book.
Okay. So for a music player, we have to go to a music player or a website store. Close up the
store. Discuss.
Yeah.
I think we can just go on, and you will get back to this in the practical assignment later. So, let's continue and get back to the questions later. Where? Rogers and co, they talk about maybe three settings: the laboratory, the natural settings, and the living laboratories. And the laboratory is a control setting. Here is where you can do very controlled things. You can put up a camera and you can ask them to press, write the sentence on the keyboard or do very, very controlled stuff. They are less possible. They are less. It's more hard to do that in a natural setting. They refer to it as in the wild study. Things can happen. It's a context. It's noisy. It might be outdoor. It might actually be a natural setting. And when I put it in natural setting, is that Rogers and her co-authors, they come from a tradition where naturally something not so contended. They don't question it, but many here comes from a media studies background, or I come from a humanist background, and there's nothing natural. It's always biased by a culture and so on. So I put it in. But what it means, you could if you expand it, I would talk about the local cultural and social setting. So it's not in a laboratory, but it's out among people, and they have their local customs and routines and so on. And also an online network setting would be a natural setting, or because you can't really control, it's so much, it's not only the technical system, but if you take social media, there is so many things that happens, and it's you can't control the setting. That's the point. And then you can discuss, can you control any setting? But yes, more. In between is an interesting method called living laboratories. And I've been using it a lot. You move the laboratory out into a setting. Maybe the most well-known example is MIT Media Lab and the Living Lab they have. So you move prototypes out into a school. You don't take the children to the university. And I found the method, it's more anthropological. You can go there with a team of experts, or you can record it and you can watch it afterwards, but it's in between the laboratory and the... And I've done all these types of studies, and I sometimes prefer the natural setting or the local, and sometimes the living laboratories. I don't seldom do laboratories studies. And what happens if you take people, I've done it sometimes, if you take people to a university, a usability lab, let's say, then people tend to dress up, feel a bit intimidated, scared. They go to the big university. They are not in their own natural setting. So you do something with them. You get other answers. I had fathers dressing up in a tie when they came to the university because they, and it wasn't, you saw on them, it wasn't natural for them. And their best dresses and so on. But the laboratory, the natural setting, and the living laboratory as a method that Rogers are giving some space in the book. When should you evaluate? Well, what stage in the project, the service, or the product's life cycle should you evaluate? You can evaluate when it's brand new. You can evaluate while it's still when during design, as you are doing in with your prototypes. You can do it on an upgrade. You can even evaluate really old stuff that is reused, restaged, redesigned. And you should also think about, for many, many products that you come across, they are services, let's say in a public sector, public service, something. It's something you have safety regulations, safety reasons for evaluating annually, or let's say in aviation, airplanes, you want them to be checked on a regular basis. But also bathrooms. If you go to McDonald's, they have a list. And if you don't have a list at McDonald's, you maybe don't want to use the bathroom. And you also have annual checkup on your car. So there is cyclic evaluations, and I find it helpful to think about the product's life cycle. So that is something that when it comes to stuff, to products, should you also evaluate how they degrade when you compose them, when you throw them away, when you... And the municipality of Oslo has made this into a big business. In Oslo you have green bags, blue bags, and white bags. And they actually, you sort it into green, meaning organic foods and stuff like that. And the blue bag are plastic. And so they sell the garbage. So evaluating a product, how well can you put different components of the products, the plastic and the paper, in if it's a package, can you put them into bags? Can you, where the house you live, reduce your cost, your garbage per year? Then you can reduce the cost for somebody collecting the garbage and so on. But to think about the life cycle can be helpful. And if you think as interaction designers, you can sell evaluation both when you design the product, when it's brand new, you make a user study of it, when it's and on the upgrade, and when you make support on the service, and when it should be disposed of. So you can offer companies your services in all stages of a product's life. Sorry. So, the types of evaluations. We've been talking about control settings with users, the laboratory and the living lab. It's still a lab. And the methods that Rogers talk about that you use in a control setting are often usability testing, experiments, more control settings. You want to check A, B, C. You have some ideas about what type of behavior you, or you have an assignment. You should see how fast they can type on a Apple new keyboard in comparison with an old one. It's good for revealing usability problems, poor for revealing contextual problems. So things that has to do with what's happening in the context where people come from. In the real world, are not so good to reveal in a laboratory. Think about the dad with a tie. That would have made him feel cheesy and not very relaxed. There, in the natural settings with users, both these are with users, as you see here. Then the most common field method is field study. So you go out and you make a field study where you try a lot of ask a lot of people, use mixed methods where you just sit there and study what they do, but you can also ask them. You ask different parties, different actors in the environment. If it's a hospital, you ask the patients, the close others, the family, the personnel, the organization. And then a third type of evaluation is any aspects not involving users. And this is an expert evaluation. Consultants and researchers critique. And here you are experts. You are consultants in this sense. You always know more about interaction design, at least not about how people live their lives, but about the interaction design. You have tools and cognitive tools and so on to deal with the different problems that a normal user doesn't have. So it's you do inspections, heuristics, walkthroughs, as we've been doing now. You do models of things and maps. We used a lot of you did maps. You mapped user needs and put them, categorized them, and so on. This is something, and also using real maps. This is something that can be very, very difficult for a person, a local person. And to take the example with an actual map, a map of an area, a geographical map, then if you go out here in town and ask them on a map, can you point out where the train station is? Somebody local would say, well, it's over there. Yeah, but can you point here? And many can't do that. So it's something about, even if you have a local knowledge, you're not maybe so trained on abstracting your own local experience or knowledge about an area. So you have other ways of, you have an expert's view on these things. You have models, you have mental models of that a user don't have necessarily. It's good for identifying obvious usability problems. And sometimes you can take maybe 80-90% of why a service doesn't work from an expert point of view. That doesn't mean that you only can rely on this, because it's poor for revealing the contextual problems, things that you would never, as an expert, catch if you didn't go out and into the natural setting, or at least in a living lab. Okay. About informing participants and getting consent. Let's see here if I... it's a bad one, but it's... this is something that we talked about with Sebastian now, that they are very they are coming in half a year. There's coming a new law, a directive from the European Union, and Norway is not part of European Union, but they seem to follow the very many of the directives, and the thing is, it will be even sharper rules about it's funny because it go hand in hand with personalization and person-centeredness and so on, but it will be stronger laws defending individual users or individual persons, and it goes both for when you are using data and spreading data, and all these things, spreading data, how you use the data, when you can say, I don't want to be part of this, I want my data to disappear again, and so on. I want to be anonymous, as you are talking about. Thank you for that. that is what is formulated in an informed consent form. And this happens to be the World Health Organization, and their informed consent basically it make a participant aware of their rights. So in any, really in any bigger study, at least something that you want to publish, I would say that the rule of thumb is that you when you go out and ask people here, or and ask them, is it okay that I record? Is it okay that I ask you a question? If they say no, you take the next. That's fine. But if you should publish something, or if you should include it in a major report of some sort, you need to make them aware of their rights. And the rights are basically you can withdraw your consent at any time. It's not that you say, now you gave me my your consent. I can use what you said, and of course I make you anonymous, but I need to use your data now. But if they say no, I don't want to, then they should. It's a right that you okay. Then I take you off the list. Your data will not be used. And it's also about stating the limited access of data and results. Who will have access to this? You should state the limitations for that. And they should be able to read about, and it might look like this. I don't know if you can see it, but you should tell about why the research is being done, what the researchers hope to accomplish. And if you work with... in health-related areas, in health education, in health, in hospitals, for instance, you have to weigh what does it cost for a person, let's say a person with cancer or another incurable illness or with pain. What does it take for that person to be in an answer? Maybe it adds to that person's suffering. And then you should weigh that against what you can use the results for. Does asking this very sick person is justified? Does that justify the results you have? Can you really say that? You can say if you have cancer and you're in a study, is your participating in that important? Can it help you? Can it help other people? Can it spread light on? So you have to argue in that way. A description of what will be done, how long you expect to participate, the risk. Maybe there involves risk. You should do something. Maybe you are meeting other persons. If you make a study, a blind, double-blind test, and you could always argue that if I give medicine to you, but not to you, is that ethically? Because if you don't get the medicine, you have to know about the risks. You might not. If you don't get the wonder medicine, then it might be a disadvantage for you. And of course, number seven, you should be able to leave the study at any time. And it must be signed before enrollment in a study. It's important, especially when it comes to medical issues and health, but also when it comes to children, for instance. And that's what says here. You should also state who is responsible and the purpose of the project, and particularly children and elderly. Why can that be that children and elderly are particularly strong rules or regulations? Why should you think about that? Yes?
They are in some way considered as the weaker parts of society. Like children are cognitively developed enough and don't know exactly what could be the good side, the bad sides of being in this thing. And the same could be when you get all the good experience, dementia, stuff like that. Or just physically weak, so basically they aren't cognitively at the same level at all.
It's right, and it's more formally than that. It's that if you're a child, it's your parents that has a responsibility. A child can't give his or her consent. A parent must give it, because a child is not an adult. And when it comes to elderly with dementia, it's the same thing, really. It's you, if you have dementia and you can't reason, and if you're not cognitively fit, then you could discuss if you should think that way, but then normally it's a family member or somebody that has the responsibility for that, and that's a formal thing. So you have to check who is in Norwegian it's called good man. I don't know how it's guardian. And when you do a health or children related projects, at least in Scandinavia, you have to do an ethics application, and there's also a formal thing that you send an application where you state, and the informed consent form is something that you have to include. This is how we will present it, and this is a big business if you think about a big business. But it's a big thing, because if you think about elderly people, should you approach the old person? Should a nurse choose this, make the selection, or should you? How do you get people to get involved? Do you go through? Can you talk to any person that has an old parent, or how do you go about this? And then you have to have made these consent forms, and you have to have a very clear picture of what you want to achieve and how you want to include the subjects then in the study. So you can say a lot about this, but when you will work with children and elderly, some of you already in the next course, you will get back to these questions again. So this is almost the last slide. So, when it comes to interpretation of data, this is really something you have to discuss this afternoon, I think. What makes the evaluation method reliable? Roger says consistency of the method producing the same result under similar circumstances, but different methods have different degrees of reliability. You can have a quantitative method. A quantitative method that measures data or blood values or measure something very concrete, and you can have a qualitative method where you talk to people and you they tell you how they feel or so. And I wouldn't say that the quantitative method is more reliable than the qualitative. It depends on how many you involve in the study, how long you talk with them, how if you're a heartless person doing a quantitative study, then you get other results than if you're a compassionate person and so on. So it depends. And when it comes to the validity, they use words like if the evaluation measures what it's supposed to do. I'm very seldom measuring anything when I do qualitative studies, but it's more about who is saying what. And this is about taking responsibility. So I can say something as a designer, but I almost always work together with specialists in the field. But if you work with one specialist group, they say, we are right. The doctors say, we are right in healthcare. If you talk to the nurses, they say, we have the whole picture. And if you talk to the occupational therapist, they say, but the two other, they really don't understand the social. So you have to triangulate, and that's my way of thinking about validity. Validity is, it is measurements if you do a quantitative study, yes. It's how many died from this, or how many, but it's when it comes to the qualitative methods you might use, interviews, for instance, they are qualitative. You can't really measure anything. You can say that you had 5 interviews, but or 10 or 20. You can say it's better to have 100 interviews than 5, but is it really? If you want to get a deep understanding of one person's life, is it better to interview 100? No, it's not. So, and when it comes to biases, it's distorted. Expert evaluations are distorted by the experts, the doctors. They think they rule the world. They see the world through medical and medication, while the nurses look at caring and helping and supporting and so on. Both these perspectives are biased. Your perspective as a designer is biased. But as long as you know that, when you collect data and you acquire the culture know-how, get to know the locals, as long as you can reflect on that in the evaluation. It is not that you're not biased. The goal is not to be biased. We are biased. Just by coming from different cultures and different countries and having our mental models, then we have bias. So it's nothing bad. It's just something that exists. Does that make sense? So, and that's also why I think it's so important that you develop ways of reflecting over your choices. It's never the best products that wins. But hopefully it's the product that survives might be one that can develop and get better over time. And then when it comes to scope, it's about possibility to generalize from findings. And this is something that we as designers very self-assured often say, I know this area. I can sell you this product because I know the user. I know the user, I know the task, I know the situation. Therefore, I have authority in this. But can you really generalize? So the scope, it means if it's very broad, you interview 100 people, or is it a very narrow? You interview 1 person, 2, 3. You make a very narrow understanding of how fast people can write on a keyboard, or you evaluate the workflow of Statoil or anything, a big organization, let's say. It's very different scopes, what the evaluation can answer. So, to summarize, there's a close relation between design and evaluation. So, you have tried this in practice now. You have made an early prototype tested it, redesigned it, and along that you have only not only designed, but you have made evaluations all the time in the group and together with users and here in class. Methods are used both in evaluation and identifying user needs. So they are, when you try to identify user needs in the beginning with the post-it notes and doing maps and so on and sorting, you use some evaluation. You use the same methods as when you evaluated. You ask users. You discuss this. You thought about the persona, and when you evaluate, you go back to asking users. You think about personas. You make walkthroughs in the beginning of maybe state of the art things that you find out there, and then you do it on your own when you design and when you try it. So the methods are reused, and evaluation are made in control, natural and local cultural settings and expert settings. So control, usability lab, natural out among people in the real world, or in the local culture, and you do it only with experts, not users. And you should, in an evaluation, make really any participant, even if you go out and say, can you look at this napkin? What do you think about this? What is this? What type of product do you think this is? Or if you try something very early on, paper prototype, you could say that I'm this and that. I'm trying to get some answers of what this is. Could you answer some easy questions for 1 minute? I won't use it. Even if you do it orally and if you do it very narrow, you can definitely inform the participant and sort of get the consent. Yeah, that's okay. I have 5 minutes. As long as you don't take any pictures or use my name or record anything, it's okay. So, Øyvind, should I? Yeah, okay. You want to get back to it after 10 minutes? Okay. Any questions? Is it something that you is natural to you? Is it something that you know of or? I mean, we have been evaluating all the time, so. Obviously not early enough when it comes to the gradings, but that's another thing. Okay, let's take 10 minutes.
Alright. A few thoughts on achieving usability for your system. You have to start with understanding your users. You guys had some personas and you made some user stories in your tasks. And those are usually, you derive those from activities that Anders touched on, such as contextual activities, where you, for example, observe, you gather some stories, you look at how people do different things in their workplace, for example, and you start creating stories from that. You can also interview people, learn more about them, and fill that data into personas, which immediately makes them more like heavy and more fun to work with, knowing that you have real data. And the second thing is you start maybe defining your design, maybe through a conceptual model that you create from a set of scenarios. You start thinking about how to what requirements your system has. Maybe you specify those as scenarios, what the system should do. And yeah, you start getting more concrete, think about concrete scenarios, how to solve the problems you've discovered when you've gathered stories from your contextual work out in the field or talking with people. And yeah, Don Norman talks about there are these two things called the gulf of execution and the gulf of evaluation, which are very important to usability in itself. These are two things we will look at in the method called cognitive walkthrough. Cognitive walkthrough is an expert evaluation. Expert evaluations are usually pretty helpful at the start of a development project or a design project because it helps you think about obvious things like design principles, which are what you should be focusing on as an interaction designer or developer. When you do these expert evaluations, you can weed out some obvious mistakes before you spend time with actual users to make sure you don't waste their time or your time. Expert evaluations are pretty fast and cheap to do. The cognitive walkthrough usually has like four questions which you ask at each step of your, say you have a task with different steps. So you ask like four questions per step, which takes a shitload of time. So we're gonna cut that in half and think about the two questions which concern Don Norman and the gulf of execution and the gulf of evaluation. The gulf of execution is how you translate your goal into an action. So say you have a story about a guy who wants to turn on his television and he has to stop and think about how does he make that happen. So he picks up his remote and he presses the on button, usually. So he has to stop and think about his goal and how to do that in terms of technology. And the second part is the gulf of evaluation, in which the user looks for confirmation to see if he has reached or come any closer to his goal. So he probably gets some sort of feedback, maybe the television turned itself on or it made a noise or something. And those two things are very important to see if people are able to successfully use your system, if your system is usable or has a high degree of usability. So by asking the two questions which relate to this, you can uncover a lot of usability errors and to see how well your design works in allowing users to get closer to their goals, which in essence is what you are doing as a designer. You want to assist people in reaching their goals, to assist them in achieving their activities or tasks. And yeah, that is what you want to test. So what we're going to do is to have you look at each other's prototypes. You're probably tired of looking at your own prototype, so you won't have to do that today. So I will hand out these sheets, which contain the two questions. Number one, will the user know what to do at this step? And question two, if the user does the right thing, will she or he know that she or he did the right thing and is making progress towards the goal? So that means you probably have some scenario or task which we have defined for your design. If not, you can just think of a simple one. And yeah, you will assign different roles to each other. There are some examples here of possible roles for this expert evaluation. First one is facilitator. So the person who's responsible for making sure that the evaluation is going as planned, that you're following the rules. For example, a good rule to have is that you are not allowed to discuss designs while evaluating, or defending your design, or suggesting design improvements. The goal of the cognitive walkthrough is to work on identifying usability problems and how they arise, but not how to solve them, because that makes the process laborious and much more time consuming. So on the sheet you have a set of questions and a set of roles. So what I'm thinking could work is that if you go together in groups, your assignment groups together with another group, and then evaluate each other's prototypes.
How many groups are we gonna still eight or
there's two.
You have two groups.
Like one of the roles is product expert. So I'm thinking maybe people from the other group could be the product expert and explain their task and scenarios. Oh. So the important thing is not how your design looks or works, or how high fidelity prototype you've made. Most important thing is to think about your users and their ability to complete their tasks. Right. Any questions?
I have a question to you. Do you want to stay here and do it, or should we go out and go out to the next stage?
Could we bring the coffee? Yeah, so spend like maybe half an hour on this or something.
Half an hour?
Hello. 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 Hey, guys. So I think most of you are done evaluating each other, I think. We can go through each group and hear if you have some insights on it, if you have to share. So, I don't know. Did you guys find anything interesting during your evaluation of each other's? Anything you didn't expect to find? Maybe you're shocked that you had some usability issues that you didn't think about before? Or?
It was quite difficult as we had already gone through a presentation this morning.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if the issues we discovered, because they were the same as they were commented on this morning, if that was something I discovered or if it was just me repeating what was said earlier this morning. So that's one comment.
Oh, that others repeated what you had said earlier. Yeah, okay. Ah, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But we did discover some things that worked well and some things that was not working as well. Mm. And then we misunderstood that first part, so the first evaluation went a bit wrong. But
oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a learning process. Can you see any use of a cognitive walkthrough in a design process? If so, where?
Yeah.
Would you use that instead of an expert like heuristic evaluation, or would you rather use a cognitive walkthrough? Yeah.
Because you need to make sure you're on the right path, but the expert review might be good for more of a like exploration, I think. But it must depend on the product, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's a good complement to like heuristic evaluation, in that you can evaluate like task flow and how well people are able to understand your system. To transfer their knowledge or translate their goals to fit with your system. So I think if you have a good conceptual model, you will find less usability issues in your cognitive walkthrough, I think.
Can I make a comment?
Make a comment?
Then it's also about training yourself what tasks are the best to do before you can help them.
Yeah, it's very useful. We did that.
You try the task yourself that you tell the user to do it. So it's also about. It's actually good if you should test a computer game, then you can play the game yourself and know where the Easter eggs are, very good, sort of how it works. So this could also be something.
Yeah, it's very useful if you're going to prepare for a usability test, in which you need a well-defined task list and think about how to measure your different tasks. So it's good to for like pilot tests. We did that.
And it's also about reflecting on your own bias. Somebody says, let's go out there and use the open and you're actually an expert, you're an interaction designer.
Preferably not. Like with any pilot tests, you preferably maybe ask some of your colleagues. I think it's much better to remove yourself from the process of bias and everything. Yep. You guys, what did you think of the walkthrough?
I think it was kind of interesting being two evaluators at once, so that you could kind of discuss it a little bit, and sometimes like one person notices something while the other person may not have noticed it.
I think it's the same with heuristic evaluations, that you should have, I think the number was 4 to 5 evaluators actually, to uncover the most usability errors. Alright. You guys, how did you find the walkthrough? I think usually that's the way to go. Like, since it is an expert method, it's better to have it earlier, so to weed out any simple problems and stuff. Afterwards, you can test with real users. I think usually you would have to make a plan for your testing, and your plan should not just include like expert methods like this one or heuristic evaluation. You should also have user participation in your evaluation together, maybe to validate your findings of the cognitive walkthrough. I think in heuristic evaluations, for example, you tend to find issues that are not really issues as well, because you get so picky if you're an interaction designer. So you tend to overanalyze, maybe, that sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah, any other thoughts on cognitive walkthrough? Like, what do you think would be the next step after you've done the walkthrough? What would you do?
Revise
your design?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably a good idea. Maybe now that you do it as a sorry.
Content that belongs together. It's like stuff like that is being repeated a lot. That's if I should say on a small scale, so it's hard to say specific things. I would want to still a lot more users to make decisions.
Yeah, when you do a cognitive walkthrough, you might get some ideas on what you think are issues. So you may want to test out if there are actually issues or not for your users. So that's, yeah, it's useful to prepare for user tests, I think. Yeah. Any other thoughts or? Yeah. Like if you're one person doing the cognitive walkthrough all by yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that. Yeah. It could be difficult if you're doing it, but if you're doing it on someone else's design and you're the only person doing it, you still have to take notes and pay attention to the screen, and like it can get distracting. So doing it as a group is, I think, is better. And practicing to assign roles when testing is very important, I think, to have clear and defined roles. I think that goes for all testing. You should have like a facilitator, a note taker, and an evaluator. Like if you invite people into your laboratory and they come in and there's like three people greeting them, like, hey, they don't know who they're gonna address, and it might be easier if you have clear defined roles and who's taking notes and that sort of thing. It is useful to evaluate existing products. Like you can do a hierarchical task analysis of an existing task in, for example, Spotify and stuff. And then you learn more about the way they do it. And then you maybe can replicate that to your design or get some inspiration that way. In the back. Yeah. I think it depends what you're looking at. Maybe if it's like a think aloud thing, maybe. I think it's better to be closer to the group so that you can see the interface and what is happening. I think. If that's of importance to what you're testing. But yeah. If you're a lot of people like this, then it could interfere.
Facial expression, and you might help. And you can also then discuss it afterwards. So that works for me at least. But again, as you said, if you have it more talk out loud session, then it's more about sharing and maybe create the nice atmosphere and it's a relaxed situation. So sometimes it's not that important to record and to it depends on if it's very complex and you need to have a second opinion. Like from people that are not there, and then you have to think about those things. Who are motivated and what are you motivated? Or do you think do you record?
I think when you do projects, you're going to find that it's very important to generalize your findings from these sort of evaluations and to communicate them to other people on the team, not just hand them the Google Doc with the three pages that they're not going to look through. So communicating findings from these sort of evaluations is also very important. But it tends to be forgotten because after the end of the evaluation, which took like 3-4 hours, you're pretty tired, so you just do it the next day. When you don't remember anything from experience. I guess this is the last seminar. I think we're getting done. Any questions or comments? It's been very interesting being a seminar assistant to you guys. I think I learned a lot being here, and it's very interesting to see your work. You're very good. So well done.
Thank you. What will you be doing now? Because you actually have another work as well.
Yeah, my master thesis.
Yeah.
Almost forgot. You've been helping me forget about that, but now I have to get back to it. Yeah, it's going to be on universal design and agile development. Should be cool.
But I already asked you if you could continue to be the student assistant, but you said no, I don't have time. So, but I'm very happy to do it now.
You'll see Tuva.